7, and we're having some testimony this evening to start with. We'll follow that with a comparison of the key concepts of the major bills we've been looking at. So I would ask that Chris DeMars come up first, Northwest Health Foundation. And Gretchen Morley, are you coming up with him or with her? I'm sorry.
This is Mark, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you. Get started.
Okay. Chair Bates and Chair Westland, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris DeMars, and I'm a program officer with the Northwest Health Foundation. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative. And after I speak, Gretchen Morley, the director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, will provide an overview of the consensus statement on health reform that the collaborative has recently developed. To provide some context, the Northwest Health Foundation was founded in 1997 with the mission to advance, support, and promote the health of the people of Oregon and Southwest Washington. During its early years, the foundation achieved this mission primarily through grant making that responded to community-defined needs. As the Northwest Health Foundation approaches its 10-year anniversary, we recognize that while funding direct services is important and valuable, systemic change is necessary to turn the tide of significant unmet need. Simply put, we understand that foundation grants alone are not likely to result in sustained improvements in community health. The Northwest Health Foundation values the opportunity to serve as a convener, to provide a neutral forum for the community at large to discuss the state of Oregon's healthcare system and to work together to identify solutions. Thus, our involvement in convening the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative makes perfect sense. The Oregon Health Reform Collaborative has its origins in an early 2006 meeting of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, which was sponsored by the Northwest Health Foundation. This meeting provided a forum for discussion between the diverse groups working to improve healthcare access in Oregon, and it underscored the need for more cooperation and collaboration among these groups. After this meeting, the Northwest Health Foundation and the Oregon Health Policy Commission, under the direction of Gretchen Morley, agreed to help meet that need by offering to bring these groups together on a regular basis. So since last February, approximately 15 organizations representing consumers, businesses, providers, labor, insurers, as well as legislative staff have been participating in the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative to find ways to support each other's efforts and enter the legislative session with a common vision and message for a vastly improved healthcare system in Oregon. Initially, the collaborative focused on building trust and awareness of each other's different approaches to health reform. The group also worked to develop a joint messaging platform and created a web portal, www.oregonhealthreform.org, to promote public involvement in health reform with information and links to organizations participating in the collaborative. During the legislative session, the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative is serving as a venue for the member organizations to strategize how to help pass legislation, which will lead to hopefully comprehensive health reform, to build relationships and support of reform legislation, and to coordinate reform-related activities. Setting their individual agendas aside, the collaborative has recently outlined a set of broad principles and the necessary first steps for health reform in the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative consensus statement that you have in front of you. This statement has been signed by the following organizations: the Archimedes Movement, Code Blue Now, Healthcare for All Oregon, the Medicaid Advisory Committee, Metropolitan Alliance for the Common Good, the Northwest Health Foundation, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, the Oregon Business Council Healthcare Task Force, Oregon Health Action Campaign, Oregon Health Policy Commission, Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Primary Care Association, Oregonians for Health Security, Pacific Source Health Plans, and the Working Families Party. The collaborative is currently seeking to expand the list of organizations that signed the statement and participate in the collaborative. Next, you'll hear from Gretchen Morley, who will talk about the Oregon Health Reform Consensus Statement. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gretchen?
For the record, my name is Gretchen Morley, I'm director of the Oregon Health Policy Commission. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee tonight. I think what, just as Chris was saying in terms of background, as you know, the commission had been working all year on a health reform plan at the request of the governor. That was one set of activities the commission was doing. The other set was, outside of any particular reform plan, working to convene the tremendous energy from the groups that are interested in working on the reform this past year and into the next years to come. So working with the Northwest Health Foundation was a tremendous opportunity for the commission. I think you're going to be hearing from Dr. Janine Smith after we're done here on the various reform bills that are currently under consideration and the commonalities between those bills. And I think the takeaway from what I would say today is that, one, you're going to find many parallels between what you're working on right now, what you're looking at, the three bills, with this consensus statement you have in front of you, and that the consensus statement indicates to you or provides you with more support for your work, that there really is tremendous energy and support out there for both large, keeping the eye on large-scale reform as well as trying to put some building blocks in place right now to move toward that. I think just to hit on some highlights, the consensus statement really is showing that these groups have a common vision for comprehensive reform that's affordable, accessible, equitable, and efficient, that would provide that health care, defined as those words, to all Oregonians. Comprehensive reform means both expanding health care access as well as addressing the deep systemic problems in the current system. And I know those are both components of all of these bills that you're talking about tonight. As you look down through the principles, you're going to see a number of the words that you see in many of the bills. It shows some pretty deep consensus out there on what everybody's looking for. Just to highlight some of the key words in the principles, I won't read them word for word because you have them there in front of you, but you have equitable access to affordable health care for all Oregonians. You have health care that's high quality, coordinated, timely, and comprehensive. You have a workforce that meets the demand for needed care, a system that's equitably paid for by everybody involved, one that's efficient, cost-effective, sustainable, understandable, accountable, and one that provides really the information, the resources, the incentives to both providers and patients to promote health and reward the use of prevention and other proven treatments, and one overall that optimizes the public health. So as just running through that quickly, I'm sure you're hearing a lot of things that mirror the efforts of this committee and the House as well, as well as the Oregon Business Council and the Health Policy Commission. So I think it just indicates that people are on the same page. And then just to specifically highlight while they wanted to make sure that the focus stays on large-scale reform, saw the need that there really is a need for the building blocks and what can we do right now to move it forward. And on the consensus statement, you'll see listed there for one, expanding health care coverage to all kids, moving forward the concept of all Oregonians having a primary care home, developing a plan for health care reform, which is fairly the conversation for this evening and this committee, and pushing the federal dialogue around using resources more sustainably and rationally. So I think we hope that this statement gives support to all of your work, and the collaborative is available to you as a resource to assist you in work in any way possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Mitch.
Thank you,
sir. Well, Representative Greenlick, I'm
Mitch,
sorry.
Mitch, please.
Okay.
We're just folks talking to each other. It struck me that is it possible to get a consensus statement by keeping things at a high enough level so there aren't enough details to begin to argue about? I mean, for example, there isn't anybody here that doesn't agree with the statement it'd be fairly paid for by individuals, employers, and government. We all agree with that. What the consensus statement doesn't say is there should be a national income tax to pay for the lottery. I mean, how much further into detail you suppose we could move with the consensus statement before it begins to fall apart as a consensus?
Chair Westland, Chair Bates, Chair Greenlick. I think just to comment on the collaborative's discussion has been at the level of principles, consensus, and discussion about which bills would reach those. I think you're right that the devil's in the details. I think that probably the context for having those deeper level conversations are in a much more public setting such as this, and I don't think the collaborative had gone to that level for those reasons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chris, the short-term bullet points you have, one of which talks to requesting permission to demonstrate how federal funds can be used more efficiently in Oregon. Was there a discussion about whether that means Medicaid and Medicare or just Medicaid? We're getting a devil of details here, okay? I want a little of this flushed out at the end.
Chair Bates, Chair Westland. The collaborative has talked mostly about which bills kind of referred to each of the bullet points, and for that particular bullet point, Senate Bill 27 was seen as the kind of corollary bill. So in that case, it would be, I guess, Medicaid and Medicare.
Would you concur with that, Gretchen?
The collaborative members, just to repeat exactly what Chris just said, the collaborative members did talk about the bills that would meet the...
be supportive of Medicare and Medicaid being potentially waivered.
Yes.
Okay. The other issue I asked about was, or is interesting to me, is we're seeing many things across the country right now where we're talking about access, 100% universality as far as access is concerned. But as far as I know, the only serious discussion about controlling cost has been occurring in the state of Oregon. I see affordable, meaning from what I see here, affordable to me, the way it's, the context is, it's affordable to the individual. Was there a discussion about actually controlling health care costs in the state?
I think Chair Bates... I think just to take it back to maybe also what Representative Greenlick was talking about as well, the collaborative has not gone to the level to talk through specifics as to what, say, cost containment measures would meet these principles. The principles do outline that they would expect health care reform to address that issue.
Okay, well, I appreciate your testimony tonight. I would tell you that, from my point of view at least, getting access 100% across the board is easily within our reach compared to actually controlling costs, because without controlling costs, as we've said over and over again, 3, 4, or 5 years from now, we lose access again, even if we got everybody under the tent right now. And Gretchen, I understand they're debating your and my bill right now about provider taxes. Remember that 3 years ago when you helped me author that bill?
Senator Bates, I'm not...
I was a representative.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sorry. I slipped back. I wouldn't call that my bill necessarily.
Well, I will say it was mine at least, and I appreciate your help at that time. You were very, very helpful in getting that bill into workable shape, and I appreciate that. It was a long time ago, 3, 4 years and politically, but it's something that worked well for the state, saved some of the standard program, and I think it's still something you should be proud of. I appreciate your work when you helped us with that. And I expect the same kind of help this time, too. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair.
Chris, I see at the end of your letter, you can make a difference today. You know, we're all over this call to action thing. It says sign and send this page to your state and federal representatives. Where do they sign this page?
Chair Westland, Chair Bates.
Am I missing something?
That's a great point. Thank you for pointing that out.
I mean, you got to. I'm happy to get 100,000 of these. Oh, wait. What's your address, Peter? I want to put that out over the air. No. I think this is great. This is wonderful. So. But you've got to have a specific place for them to put their signature, address, and contact information back so we can, you know, do the call for action thing.
It's a good point. We can make it more user-friendly.
And then secondly, could you please pass on to Thomas that we're just all very glad that you came down to present this evening and not Thomas? Very articulate.
I might tell him that.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll try to get the message through for him.
Yeah.
A little comfortable with that.
I'd like to differ with Senator Westland. Please ask him not to send it to me.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony tonight. Thank you. Good to see you both again.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to a comparison of Senate Bill 329-27 and 3368, House Bill 3368. Master Jeanine Smith, or Dr. Smith to come up here, and I assume Lori's coming with you.
Yes,
Lori Freeman.
Dr. Reese, can I comment on what you said just a minute ago, which is really interesting. I mean, when we talk about affordability, and it's in here, I see it under under the health insurance activity. We really continue to talk about affordability on an individual basis, didn't we? And all the conversation in the commission, and it's sort of, I guess we mean sustainability when we're talking about it on a affordability on a social sense. That's really kind of interesting.
When I read this, it made me think of affordable for the individual.
And that is, I think, what's meant.
That's what's meant, and that won't work in the long run. It's got to be affordable for our society as a whole, not just the individual. It goes right to sustainability. It's not sustainable if we can somehow start bringing costs under control. It just isn't going to get. That's what got us in trouble in the first place. We didn't have high costs in health care, we wouldn't have an access problem. But we do. So we have to bring those things under control. Dr. Smith, welcome this evening. And Lori, good to see you again.
Thank you.
Okay. Twice in one day is probably about all you can tolerate. So we'll try to make this as painless as possible, okay? And the way I like to work this tonight, since this is a fairly complex issue of comparing these, I want to make sure we're all working off the same sheet, okay? And I assume it's this one? Or is it this one?
Well,
or is it this one over here?
Chair Bates, the one pager is sort of a consensus of kind of showing where there's been consensus to date from listening and where there are still some areas of debate. So it's more of a one page sort of pulling it all together I was going to walk through just briefly first, and then we could go to the matrix, which has got the actual side by side.
Sounds like a great plan. So long as everybody in the audience and the committee is on the same page, literally, we should do all right. Okay. And I'm also going to ask that as we go through this, that we not hold our questions, that we ask questions as we go along, because if you wait that long on something this long a topic, we're going to lose each other. So go ahead and start, and then please feel free to chime in with questions.
And Senator Bates, for the record, it's Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. And I would also add that I don't know if I'll have all the answers. It's really to help speed your discussion amongst yourselves as well. So, but looking at the one-pager, there's titled Areas of Agreement on the top and then Major Remaining Issues. What we tried to capture with staff in my office and working closely with your staff is kind of where there seemed to be some substantial agreement among the major reform plans. Access to health insurance for all Oregonians, of course, being very key. Health covering all children. Requirement for everyone to have health insurance. Encouraging realignment of incentives and initiatives to improve cost effectiveness as well as access. Encouragement of efforts to improve quality of care. Importance of the use of realigning incentives to improve cost effectiveness and quality. Supporting health information technology such as electronic health records and transparent data on cost and quality. The principle of a shared responsibility among all stakeholders. The need to leverage and maximize federal funds brought into the state. The importance of raising some other federal level issues after your discussions with former Governor Kitzhaber in regards to Medicare, employer-sponsored tax and benefits of tax benefits taxation, and the need to phase this in, including some short-term activities, as well as to address more complex ones. And that's kind of a global overview of kind of where we've heard some general agreement along lines. And looking at most of the bills, that's what you'll see as we go through them. Leading for major remaining issues, exactly what source...
Can I ask a question, please?
Yes.
It seems there's something else, and maybe it's buried in one of these. I think all three have an assumption of pretty major change in the way healthcare is going to be delivered. That assumption. Now, do you have that in one of these check marks, or do you disagree that that's an underlying assumption of of all three bills?
No, I would probably agree with that because, thinking what the three are is sort of the basis of what the Health Policy Commission has discussed and what you have captured in your bill and the other 329 and 27 is the delivery system infrastructure changes are very key to all of those. They maybe have a little different wording about how they get there, but there is the essence that the system isn't working well now and it needs to be improved. So that's probably a good point we should add to the top part.
But Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to echo and underscore Representative Greenlick's point there, because you go through all these checks and that's what it's saying, but that's really the first beginning point. That's the first building block, first recognition, first cognition that, oh, wait a minute. The old phrase, incremental change won't get us there. Comprehensive reform is required. I think that's a very important point. And I think that needs to be underscored. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes.
Was there ever a discussion of EMTALA in the second to last bullet? You talk about ERISA.
Question?
EMTALA?
EMTALA. And I don't know what the acronym emergency.
It's like a 1987 Chevy.
It's the hospital requirements.
That's close.
Representative Maurer, Chairs Bates and Westland, EMTALA, which I probably can't remember the exact acronym either, is related to the federal regulations around having to see a patient in the emergency setting.
Yes.
And decide what they need and see how urgent they are before you ask them what their insurance status is. And so ERs are obligated to see patients because of EMTALA rules.
Right. So my question was that wasn't discussed.
I haven't heard a specific discussion about EMTALA in Senator Bates and Westland's committee, and the Health Policy Commission really didn't touch upon it.
We have not really addressed that specifically. We'll bring it up for later discussion. Good point.
One other comment. It seems like the bullet right above it says need to leverage available federal funds. If you get the next bullet, then the one above it disappears because it has been leveraged. If they say, here's your bucket of money, go forth and spend it, then there's no more leveraging.
Representative Maurer, Chair Bates, and Westland, I think that the first bullet was more maximizing Medicaid federal dollars, and so probably the second bullet doesn't necessarily have Medicaid in there, so you probably could lump them all together collectively.
Any other questions?
Okay.
All right.
So on the bottom, just briefly, there seemed to be some major remaining issues, and we'll touch upon these as we go through the bill, but source of funds to expand access to coverage, the role of the employers in providing benefits and contributing to premiums, the benefits to be provided in the sense of not exactly what benefits, but exactly who determines the benefits, with one of the bills very succinctly talking about Health Services Commission and others not as direct. Design and role of insurance exchange, purchasing pool, and then what this entity, everybody has a different entity, board, trust board, et cetera. So, on that note, we'll go to the matrix, which Rick has up on the slide.
Are you going to lead us to the matrix? I would tell you, I've watched the movie Matrix twice. Don't understand it, but I hope I do better on this one, okay?
On the matrix, we have multiple matrices in our offices. We've compared everything. We wanted to try to capture, 329 in its current conceptual draft is on the left. The Archimedes Senate Bill 27 is in the middle. And then the House Bill 3368 is on the right. Then we tried to think of what kind of ways to, and you could do it 17 different ways of how you would analyze these, but we took kind of just tried to walk through sort of some common things that we had heard from the Health Policy Commission's discussions and see whether they sort of landed in these, and that was sort of how we got started, and then we added some more categories based on where there was agreement and where we thought there wasn't. So starting the first box, it was more...
Excuse me just a second. Can the audience see that all right? Do you need the lights off more?
The light should be off on the screen.
Yeah, I bet.
In front.
There's lots of copies in the back for there were.
And we need the light.
The light right above this.
That's the wrong lights off, I think.
Yeah, the one above the screen is what's messing it up.
Hey, now we're talking.
Yeah.
You guys get to go to sleep, and we stay awake, so yeah. It's a good deal.
And I'll go ahead and have Lori chime in whenever she wants to make sense of this. But in 329, as we've discussed here, you have want to establish a trust board to administer the health fund program, and that a board will have abilities as the current authority is to contract with health plans and to develop some policies governing the program. And then there are the subsections within 329 where those powers or authority are outlined. If you look at the Archimedes Senate Bill 27, it has the authority over development and some policies governing the program, and then they're to report back to the legislature for implementation, and they also have contracting authority with the plans. And then in the House Bill 3368, it's more layered on top of the current system where they just create a new thing called the Health Insurance Corporation that's given authority to operate over just the exchange to negotiate benefit packages and can collaborate with other state entities to do its work.
Janine, any questions? Janine, do we have anybody here from the Health Policy Commission who might give us a like sort of executive look at the what they mean by the exchange exactly, what they expect that to do, what how it actually would function. I'm still a little vague on that at times, and I think others are too.
Chair Bates, I think Gretchen had to go home for childcare, but I can try to answer some of those. We do have sort of an issue paper that Gretchen and I have been developing to kind of outline sort of the issues around it, but it's also in more detailed in our health policy report. But essentially what Massachusetts set up, it was it's sort of a market organizer where they try to collectively make it a resource for small business individuals to purchase insurance, since they were being mandated to ask for individual coverage.
I'm sorry, who would be mandated?
I'm using the Massachusetts example as the only one that currently exists. Is since they're mandated to buy insurance, then they wanted to create a forum in which people could buy it.
Is it the individual person?
Individual person, and also as a resource for small business.
Maybe large.
And possibly large businesses as well.
But businesses aren't mandated in the Massachusetts plan, I don't believe.
There's an employee requirement that if they don't buy it for their own employers, then they need to pay something. So there is an incentive there for them to participate, and so there would be packages that could be created just for the exchange, and certain ones would be in the Health Policy Commission's discussions was that there would be subsidies for some of those products if they met certain requirements, and then people who could not afford them could have access to certain products. So it's kind of a bringing people together to be able, I mean, have a one place to go, one-stop shopping, so to speak.
A clearinghouse.
But also could be similar to your model where you have accountable health plans. I mean, in some ways, that was the same concept, that there would be a sort of a certain standard in which some of those would be subsidized so that there would be a series of collection of benefit packages people could choose from.
In Massachusetts, it also had the ability to provide 222 plans or something, plans to provide, to allow people to buy health insurance with pre-tax dollars.
They're trying to sort that out, but ideally was that they could, you know, buy something for less by not having it be after-tax dollars.
So they could buy with pre-tax dollars, which would be an advantage, and they'd be trying to connect them with certain types of policies, catastrophic or...
And it was sort of also a pooling mechanism that would pool into larger groups purchasing. They merged their small business and individual market together into one market. They also, you know, saves a small business employer from having to go shop for a benefit package for them, for their employees. Doesn't totally exclude agents. Agents would still be participating as part of the exchange.
So brokers would still be involved.
Yeah.
I'm trying to determine how that would, how an exchange would differ from what we presently have with brokers. And what I just heard, I believe, was one, you'd be bringing in the individual market and try and make it more of a group market. We've heard testimony before that that would help a little bit, but not a lot, but some, which is worthwhile. And that, but what I see written here also is negotiating benefit packages. That means it helped. How does that package look like? Is that the goal?
That they would help set some standards, similar to your discussions of standard of what a package would be that would then qualify for subsidy.
I think there was a feeling that it could manage the insurance market as well. I mean, that it actually could manage the market, particularly for individual, for things that were mandated under the individual and perhaps even under the small group. It was an attempt to make small group available. I mean, the Health Commission report, Health Policy Commission report, has a much stronger stick that goes with the employer mandate than Massachusetts does, which was, what, $350 or something per employee per year.
Would this envision potentially some of the work being done by DCBS being taken over by the exchange? Is that it? Part of the concept possible?
Well, in Massachusetts, the exchange lives within the Department of Insurance.
It moves in the direction. And is there any, it would seem possible to me, others may want to comment on this, that the exchange could be a part of any board that was set up, too. There'd be no reason the board couldn't have that same function as part of the board itself.
Well, the Senator Bates and committee members, it could be that, you know, the exchange is probably one aspect. I mean, the overall board will have a lot of things to do based on all the things that you want to oversee. So could the exchange be a portion of, or one sort of entity that's a sub-entity, so to speak, that's dealing with the accomplishing that? While you made some other aspects similar to SB 27, there's various subcommittees working on different aspects. This would be more just an exchange entity unto itself. They could cross-pollinate in terms of standards that they're each creating, so make sure nobody's working at cross-purposes between the two.
Senator Morissette.
Maybe this has been discussed, but looking across the oversight, the three columns, the Archimedes principle says reporting back to the legislature for implementation and so on. It doesn't say anything about the Oregon Health Trust Board or the Oregon Insurance Exchange Corporation. Is there going to be legislative oversight?
I will answer that myself if I can. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the Archimedes principle specifically says that. The others do not.
Especially in the design phase of this as it comes back in 08. Absolutely. Whether we want to continue that and what way it would continue afterwards is something that's a very good debate because you don't want this board politicized.
Well, I guess my feeling is the legislature is automatically responsible, whether they like it or not, for the creation that they come up with. I mean, at some point, the legislature will be responsible.
And I would expect, since Medicaid funds are involved with state match money, that they'll be automatically involved.
But at some point, that will be stated in the...
Yeah. My expectation, and Lori will possibly answer that for you, but yes. Representative Maurer.
Well, and Senator Morissette's question actually leads exactly to where I'm going, is where is the, is there an oversight in Senate Bill 329? And it gets back to currently we have 31 mandates. Legislature looks at those mandates, insurance mandates, individually. They weren't put there because of evidence base. They were put there because it was a political action. You know, it may have evidence supporting it. It's not the point. But in 329, do we get past that so that these packages are put together because that's the best practice of the day? without, and we can't go in and say, well, you know what, I want it because this is my pet project or this is my pet mandate.
Yeah, the phrase that I've used that people have laughed at me for using is Piggly Wiggly. We have mandates all over the map that we just laid on year after year after year without any particular logic to them other than just what you've said. And some have been federal mandates for that reason. You know, mammograms can be obtained directly for women, and it's good that they are, but as a result of something happened at the federal level. Those kind of things happen, and you don't have a uniform system for developing it. As an example, I'll give you how it works and can't work. 2 years, a session before last, we decided that, based on good scientific evidence at that time, that a colonoscopy for everyone over the age of 50 was a good screening device and had value, and outcomes were good because of it. What if tomorrow, and we're working on this, we have a blood test that tells you when you have one cell that's a cancer, and screening is no longer appropriate action to take. And at that time, you only check people who have had a positive blood culture or blood finding. That kind of illogic could occur easily when you're in essence having a board, i.e. the state legislature, decide how you go about laying out what would be in a benefit package. Because that, in essence, is what we're doing when we do mandates. It makes not always good sense. So I would say your answer to this is yes, the Oregon Health Trust Board or the Oregon Health Fund Board, its responsibility would be to lay out essential benefit packages and services that are based on outcomes and good medical knowledge and the ability to move those as new knowledge becomes available without relying on the state legislature to come in and say this one, that one, this one, that one.
Okay, so the looking at the three programs, so 329, the legislature does not have that type of individual oversight. I mean, they have a grand oversight. I'm not going to dismiss that reality. But the Archimedes puts it back to the legislature. And I don't see 3368. I don't see how the legislature is not involved in that decision.
I think that in 3368 and 329, there are both strong oversights. In 27, the way I read it was, reporting back to the legislature was for discussion of implementation initially. I don't think the language in 27, if you dig into it, is that much different as far as a benefit package is concerned. But I'm going from memory now. Okay. Jeanine, can you help me here? I mean, this particular question being asked is, do these all have the ability to set a benefit package, which essentially is what we're talking about, which includes services? I think all three of them probably do that.
Debates and Representative Maurer. I'd say that the health exchange, at least in the discussions with the Health Policy Commission, could set benefit packages for those within the exchange. And I think, again, it's a kind of scope. And Senate Bill 27 is a broader, where everybody will have the same package as a basic core. And then yours, 329, is... You have accountable health plans, each having, and I'm not sure you have total agreement on whether all those plans will be exactly the same or not. But they all have some benefit setting authority, in the sense of the Health Policy Commission had talked about using the Health Services Commission prioritize a list as a possible basis for those plans that would be subsidized. Not necessarily if someone wanted to buy another plan that they wouldn't necessarily, and they wanted to pay full price, would we like pulled them to the Health Services Commission list. So I don't think we got, I mean, Representative Greenlick could probably refresh my memory on the discussions, but they didn't get down into the specifics of setting a benefit package specifically. Does that answer your question?
Senator Morissette.
Yeah, to what extent did the legislature mess around with the Oregon Health Plan benefits that were prioritized? Once they were prioritized, did the legislatures, I don't think, interfered with them, did they?
Yeah, the way the priority list is set up is that the legislature can move the line up and down within federal limits, which limited us a great deal, but they can't change things in the lines themselves. They can't move those lines around. So it depoliticized it. You can move up to a certain level or down a different level, but you can't play with the list itself. So from that point of view, it's successful. And frankly, it saves the state about $50 million a biennium just for what we have, amazingly.
I envision the legislature having that kind of general oversight, but not necessarily specific. But I don't know if you can prevent them other than by the federal regs. But
You have to receive an okay from the feds to move the line under Medicaid law. That was part of the waiver. And we were allowed to move it somewhat, but not as much as some people liked, although I would say that the debate would have quickly found a line about where it was anyway. Let me kind of go through process here. Process here. We have a long ways to go in this. We also have Wednesday night. The idea is to go through these looking for consensus, basically, as we go through. So when we bring this new bill forward that is a compilation of this, we'll have some consensus. Representative Maurer, what I thought I heard from you was you were approving of the idea that this board, this entity, would have the ability to lay out the benefit package and that it should not be done individually, piece by piece, by the legislature. Is that what I heard?
Well, are you trying to put words in my mouth?
No, I'm trying to make sure I understand you.
My point is, if you're going to build a benefit package that is the minimum, it has to be built based on current science, on what is the package that is best today. It can't be a political process where we piecemeal in mandates and then expect this to be affordable and sustainable. And for the very reason that you just mentioned, that what is good today isn't necessarily good tomorrow. And so, you know, this board has to be protected, or it has to be protected enough to say, well, this is the core benefit package, and this is what, you know, within justification, but this is it. And you either, if you don't accept it, then you have Washington and Idaho and California to go to.
I think I heard you correctly the first time, and thanks for restating it.
Well, just a quick comment on Senator Morissette's very good point. And to take exception to your interpretation, Mr. Co-Chair, there was one occurrence in the dark days of the special sessions when, at this very dais, an e-board cherry-picked into the line and took out some pretty important services. It was all financially driven, not, you know, public policy driven, that we quickly reinstated in the 03 session. Mental health, drug and alcohol,
and
dental,
and
vision, a couple others that, I mean, just proved to be a disaster. And again, maybe to underscore the point, is once, you know, the pros from Dover, in this case, you know, Health Services Commission, did the very good work they did, it's best to leave that list alone. Before we proceed any further, have we created the worst of all worlds with a graphic you can't see on the board and no lights to read off?
Or so, some light back there.
Can we, not those lights, these lights.
Can we turn these central lights on?
Right.
I'm going over here.
Yeah, poor Anna is now going to do the flips. Yeah. All right.
Everybody wake up in the back row there.
Yeah.
Rick.
Senator Bates and Westland, your able-bodied staffer pointed out that in Section 19 there is in 329 reference to a report back to the legislature. So it's not quite exactly worded the exact same way as in 27.
Same with me. I am as well.
Section 19, is that better?
Thank you. Well, I think the folks in back might have been having a hard time.
Section 19 and 329, the conceptual draft, does have reference to a report back to the legislature, so there is covered.
But it doesn't report back on a specific benefits package, the overall program,
right,
correct?
Right, correct.
Okay. Senator Morissette, are you comfortable with that explanation? Thank you.
329, 3368 does not do that. It says the exchange has the ability to negotiate benefit packages with carriers and the brokers.
Representative Grinnick, would you characterize that the packages might be significantly different from one another?
You're talking about 3368?
3368. Yeah, it's got this guy, Representative Grinlick's name on it, so I thought maybe you could tell us something.
Yeah, well, it was a conspiracy. Lori couldn't put her name on it. As
Oh, it's Lori's bill.
I think it is different in some ways. I mean, it's. I characterize it as kind of Massachusetts on steroids. I mean, so it pretty much is a. You know, we took in the Health Policy Commission. We said, okay, here's Massachusetts. Well, how about this? Well, that's not very good. Let's do this instead. But we sort of built it off the Massachusetts plan. So, I mean, I think it's much less revolutionary than I think either 329 or 27, but it has some very specific details. I think, although I was looking for the duties of the exchange and it's not in there. You did not find them. I can't find them either. But it does have that kind of tax piece in it that's different.
Yeah, and Mitch, one of the things I like about the exchange, it's something that I consider doable now, something we can set up and really help people obtain health care insurance at this time. I'm not sure that you wouldn't harm the program by having a robust package that might be, since there's nothing to supplement it, that wouldn't be too costly. You know, if you were getting people together for primary care, catastrophic care, and running it through the exchange and bring them together as a group, that would seem to me to be something that has immediate value.
Yeah. 3368 is an insurance approach, and it really does focus on expanding existing insurance coverages in a way that's efficient.
Right.
It also has healthy kids built into it, which is interesting because it was in the report.
So, Laura, are you taking notes on these?
Whenever I hear consensus, Chair Bates, I write it down.
Senator Morissette.
Just a quick question. Whatever happened to the Orwellian entity? Did we get rid of that term, the entity? Do we substitute the Oregon Health Trust Board?
Senator Morissette and Senator Bates, your able-bodied staff told me to take the word entity out. We named it the Health Fund Board or the Health Trust Board.
Good.
It's still
good
sort of squishy what exactly it'll be called.
I think you'll find that in a committee coming, a committee near you and soon, you will have a draft bill that will have the entity named, okay? And I'm hoping that will be here soon. But we need more information from this committee in the next one, to finalize that draft and hopefully have it back to you very quickly after that for discussion. So any other questions concerning oversight? If not, let's move on to exchange purchasing pool.
The next line is really just whether there is an exchange or purchasing pool function, and to note also that that first one we spent a fair amount of time on is one that we thought there wasn't quite full discussion on anyway. But as noted here, 329 obviously has a purchasing pool of accountable health plans. 27 is pooling all the funds through the Oregon Health Fund. And then House Bill 3368, it was more the pooling mechanism is just within the exchange itself.
Do we need a discussion of pooling at all?
Well,
go ahead.
Well, under 3368, it talks about the quasi-public health exchange, which implies that you have a cooperative effort with the public sector, private sector, and so on and so forth, which is what I seem to remember from the graphic, which made sense. I like the word quasi-public, which sets it aside from just the public entity. Maybe the others are going to have that, but they don't say it. I don't see the word there for that.
Senator Morissette and Senator Bates, the Health Policy Commission had that debate about public-private, only, private-only, and kind of landed on quasi-public as where they put the exchange. I don't believe you guys have totally
settled on what the function of that entity, you know, if it's quasi. So that's why it's there, just for you to think about.
Lori, I'd like to ask you to lead us through something that actually comes up later, I think, also in financing, but I'd like to have the committee at least start thinking about this. In setting up a pool like this, we are blocked by ERISA, and you can probably phase this, but I'm going to do it. We're blocked by ERISA from telling an employer, either self-insured or one who's buying insurance, that one, they should have an insurance program or what that insurance program would look like. But we can ask for contributions broad-based and then reimburse back as we choose to those that have self-insurance or those who are insured by insurance company up to the level of whatever level we choose, obviously, but we could choose to reimburse them to their full costs. Is that a correct statement?
Chair Bates, that is correct.
You want to walk me through that from the point of view of where I got in trouble today with it, talking to you? Or was it just too confusing to do that?
And can you get closer to the mic?
Yes. I think something that everybody has been struggling with on these three bills is when you partner with the private sector to provide health insurance, you want to make sure that the public funds are going to be spent on a benefit package that is a minimum package, an essential package, or whatever. The problem is that you run into trouble with ERISA once the state starts regulating in any way what has to be contained in the package. So, for example, you can't say, if you don't provide this package of benefits, you are going to be penalized or you have to pay something. But what you can do is say, we're going to offer packages of benefits, or you can offer your own packages of benefits. And on the other side, the tax side, we're going to give you a tax credit for the amount of money that you pay towards premiums. So you can sort of create an incentive to buy insurance by giving employers a tax credit or some other means of subsidizing the cost, but you can't get into the package itself and say this is what you must provide. And so I think that's sort of weaving its way through all of these is difficulty, to the extent that you want to let employers provide their own package of benefits, but you want to ensure a minimum package. That's where you run into the conflicts with ERISA.
Further question, I have one if nobody else does. How is Massachusetts dealing with this? They have a very small amount that if you don't have insurance for your employees, you pay into the pool. It's like $369 a year or something, not per month, but per year. Now, are they doing that by asking each employer to put that amount in and then reimbursing, or are they actually saying, because of what they've said, as I understand it, is that you're exempt from that contribution if you have insurance? That sounds to me like an ERISA violation, the way we're understanding it here.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe you can help me. I can't remember if everyone's...
We were told the basic principle is that if you have a broad-based tax that applies to everybody, then you can do that. In this case, it has a 2% or 2.5% or whatever it was, percent excise tax per employee. And then you can forgive that. You can provide a rebate if somebody's done something. And the only question is, can you say, we'll give you a rebate if you provide health insurance that's equivalent to whatever is being provided at the minimum here? And I think at one point we came down with not bothering to say that. You provide health insurance, you get the rebate.
And also, I think Massachusetts does have a consensus committee that was determining what the minimal amount you had to offer in order to be getting the refund back on your tax.
So they're doing as a refund back. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's where they're going around the rest of them.
They have this other thing that has to do with if you don't provide health insurance and your employees use some large amount of uncompensated care, you have to pay into a different fund.
If you're if your employee shows up in the emergency room and incurs uncompensated care costs, those are then they go back to the employer to make them pay a portion of those costs, in addition to that $350 penalty.
Okay.
Senator, that $350 doesn't go to pay the cost of health care, right?
Right.
It does not go.
It's not assumed to help off. It's just an extra, you know.
Goes to general fund?
I think it goes into that unreimbursed care fund.
Yeah.
Okay. That would make sense.
Yeah, I have a question about how Senate Bill 329 deals with this interface of employer-provided insurance and the state benefit or the board's benefit or the accountable health plan benefit. I understand that 3368 creates an incentive via the payroll tax and then the giving back of those dollars to employers to offer a certain type of benefit package, and I think the Senate Bill 27 ultimate vision is a federal waiver of ERISA, taking all those federal dollars and sort of supplanting, as well as the employer tax deduction and supplanting, or at least creating a pretty big incentive for employers to allow the state to supplant the employer-sponsored care. It's not as clear to me what Senate Bill 329 does with respect. Does it sort of leave the existing, at least to start, leave the existing employer-based system intact and then try to deal with the rest?
I think I'll make a stab at this for you. Senate Bill 329, I believe, needs a companion bill from the House. If you were once you've completed the superstructure, understand where you want to go, and decide how to build that pool, you need a companion bill from the House, because there's going to be some way of getting a contribution from employers and individuals which cannot be started in the Senate, is my understanding of this legally, and correct me if I'm wrong. So 329 sets up the superstructure for this, gets the actuarial work done, puts in a lot of the very important things about cost control in, but does not and cannot speak to where is the funding from the pool coming from. That has to start in the House side.
And what is the vision on that?
The vision on that would be, once we know what that needs to be, that we would then look at mechanisms for bringing that pooling together. And the function of the pool would not only be to continue to maintain, since there will be Medicaid funds in the Medicaid program, but trying to start covering those individuals who are outside of Medicaid after raising Medicaid to a very high level, so you can bring the 60-40 match down. And from what we understand of this, if I've got the legalities of it right, individual employers can maintain themselves as self-insured. They could continue to buy health insurance in the fashion we've become used to, but those outside of that would buy through the pool.
Okay.
Having said that, the health plans being offered individually to employers would still come under accountable health plans, but I would expect that self-insureds would not. But the rebate going back would be dependent on them having a benefit plan that didn't allow cost shifting.
We can require those accountable health plans purchased even by large group employers to meet certain criteria without
No, we cannot. But we can determine how much of the rebate we would offer them.
Oh, via a mechanism like 3368.
Yep.
A rebate on a payroll.
Well, we can't tell them what their benefit package would be or how it should be done, but some of the things that we would be applying to accountable health plans, which would be the same plans for non-self-insured, we could do that. We're talking about accountability and certificate of need and making things transparent. Those things could be applied across the board.
Unless we get an ERISA waiver.
I would think we could do that without an ERISA waiver.
I think my assumption is 27 sort of assumes it's going to be asking for an ERISA waiver as well.
Yes, I'm sorry. 27 assumes an ERISA waiver, I believe.
ERISA waiver,
yeah.
And Representative Cannon, I appreciate your question because it pretty much, you know, highlights part of the assumptions or the philosophy in 329, and that is, let's get the permanent board, let's get some authorities in that board to help start reducing costs now,
then have the subgroups start figuring out really what is the benefits package, how many eligibles. But just as importantly, and this is what we all forget in this conversation, just as importantly, how effective are these cost containment measures going to be? How much can we lower costs? So it's benefits, what's it cost, and then determine the most equitable financing structure. So that's why really 329 to this point is silent on the financing piece.
Thank you. Senator Morissette, do you have a question?
Well, can we learn anything from our worker comp system on this kind of insurance model? We have SAFE, which is, what is SAFE? Quasi-independent. We have Liberty Northwest, which is private. Does one of them force the other one to do certain things in conjunction? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out. We do have some, perhaps, models that we can
there look at. There may be some models there. There may be some lessons to learn from their board, too. Not that we set the same board up, but there may be lessons to learn there. Good point. Good point. Other questions? Moving on.
Senator, the next several are really more principles than just seeing if they were capped. The next several lines were principles to see if they were captured in the in the bills. First is access to health care for all Oregonians. As we said before, this is an area of agreement across all the bills. And I will move on to the health care would then include, of course, for all of Oregon's children.
Well, let's just make sure then that that's it. That's in the new draft. That's pretty simple.
Yeah, it currently is in 329's preamble, and as I said, it's in 27, and the discussions around the Health Policy Commission, it doesn't actually say it in the words of 3368.
I would offer that 3368 having an exchange would probably significantly cut down the number of uninsured, but does not implicitly say that you will have everyone insured. Is that correct?
That's correct, Senator Bates. I think in the concept the Health Policy Commission was looking at is maximizing Medicaid, and so you'd get more uninsured covered that way. You'd have the exchange to cover those between small, the kind of the gap between above Medicaid and more and higher income, so that eventually you'd get to the access to all Oregonians by sort of pulling all the pieces
that's
together.
That's a principle.
Correct.
Yeah, universal access is a principle.
Okay.
It's just how you get there. The next one is also a principle in terms of coverage for all kids. The differences really are that it's all implicitly implied in wanting to cover all Oregonians. Again, Health Policy Commission built theirs upon existing structures, so they built theirs on top of Healthy Kids. So move on to individual mandate. The Senate Bill 329 draft has a penalty for not paying the required premium. Archimedes is sort of silent on this, and as Health Policy Commission and Representative Greenlick's bill is, you know, coupling that employer requirement with the individual mandate was felt to be really important, that some states had done it with just one and not the other, and so the importance of having both together, the shared responsibility, is implied.
But I think 27, Archimedes had it in their preamble. It might be...
And I very well could have missed that, but there's a shared responsibility item, but it doesn't come out as it doesn't really clear in 27 that it's an individual mandate in the same essence in which you guys have actually put a penalty and Health Policy Commission talked about it.
Is there a penalty in 3368 for those who do not individually?
Withholding of the of your tax of your
deduction.
Tax rebate, I think it is.
So it's the same in both bills.
Yeah, I think it's pretty
bills.
Same.
Okay, fine. Next.
That sort of all feeds into the principle of shared responsibility, and that's in all three bills.
So that means the bill. We've got this much agreement already.
We're almost there, right?
Hey.
We're moving rapidly.
Time to go home.
And the last on that page is the need to leverage available federal funds. And again, getting back to the comments Representative Maurer made, this was kind of talking about Medicaid maximization. And it's in 329, it's in 27, and it's in 3368. We have agreement on that one.
Put it in the bill.
We're on to page two. And raising federal level issues, this is in more the more beyond Medicaid and getting into Medicare, ERISA, et cetera. Senate Bill 329 asks for Medicare funding. 27 asks for Medicare funding and tax exemption of employer-sponsored benefits. And it's discussed in the Health Policy Commission report, but is not explicitly outlined in 3368.
Jeanine, I made a mistake here. Can we go back to Medicaid just for a second?
Sure.
I want to see what the committee's feels about this before we go any further. One of the things we did not mention here is the categoricals for Medicaid. There's about 28 of them, if I remember now. Maybe
36. 46.
It's up to 36. One, I'm sure that 329 speaks to the elimination of categoricals. We want, everyone who is under the federal poverty level at the level we choose, whatever it may be, to be in, not the deserving and undeserving poor. The other issue with 329, I think it's in 27, is that we raise that Medicaid level as high as we possibly can, not all of whom would be necessarily in the Medicaid program. But the higher levels, they'd actually be in probably the FIAP program or one that's similar to that, so they'd be buying health insurance with a significant contribution by the individual. So those are a couple of concepts I want to make sure we're okay with here on this committee, that we not talk about opening up Medicaid just for a Medicaid program, but that it's also for the FIAP program or a program similar to that. Any...
Whatever we can do to maximize the Medicaid match is what we ought to be trying to do.
I think you're right.
It includes BEOP. It includes anything else we can do.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure.
And
I want to be pretty clear on that because we're trying to put something together here. I don't want people to have difficulty later. I'm sorry for interrupting. Go back on to Medicare.
So on to page two is the raising federal level issues need for change, and that we just... there is some differences between 27 and 329 as far as tax exemption of benefits.
We need to have a discussion on this, whether we like to or not, okay? And 329 and 27, rising to the level of asking for a waiver from the federal government on Medicare, which has never been granted, and there's no mechanism for, would take a change of law to do it. And what that waiver might ask for is something we need to be thinking about discussing. I don't expect anyone to give us an opinion or a vote tonight, but I'd like to hear people's thoughts on this committee right now, if possible, knowing that you're not being held to this at a later time. We know that if we don't resolve some issues with Medicare on a financial basis, that we'll never fix health care. On the other hand, there are huge political hurdles involved in this also. Yes, Senator Morissette.
For an evening, if we want the average amount of Medicare, does that mean other states are going to have to give up some of what they have?
Yes.
To bring up, okay, that's not going to happen.
I would not necessarily.
That's not, it's not a zero-sum game. And that's the money side, which is really a whole different question. I mean, we can all sit here right now and, you know, wholeheartedly support bringing us just to the national average of Medicare reimbursement. Great, and no one's going to argue with that. That's a different question than what this is trying to get at in terms of asking the federal government for waivers to, in my impression, allow Oregon's Medicare program to better serve the population it's designed to take care of. I mean, that's a different question and an important one.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. It would be my very simple observation that given the degree to which Medicare appears to drive our health care system, the way it's delivered, going back to the issue that Representative Greenlick brought up earlier, I mean, this is really about doing things quite differently in Oregon, having a different model for healthcare delivery. I think given the I think 40% figure that I've heard on Medicare, and someone will correct me if I'm wrong, it would be sort of quixotic to go about this task if we only are talking about sort of the maybe 30, 40, 50% of the market, that 60% at most, that is non-Medicare. I think that including that and saying, you know, we're going to get our hands on that dollar, those dollars, and operate differently, set up our care delivery system quite differently, seems to make a lot of sense.
Mr. Chair, in order to have a sustainable system, I think we have to have Medicare. I have trepidation, but I think it has to be in the bill. There's so much I want to work out and have sort of the Medicare piece at the far end of the plan that we are going to implement. I think it's going to be extremely difficult to work with the federal government regarding Medicare. But there's so much implementation that we have to do with the uninsured and, the uninsured. And once we get that going, I think things are going to start falling into place with Medicare. But I think from the very high level, that has to be part of our plan.
Others? Mitch?
Yeah, I want to see if I can make myself as clear as possible.
You would appreciate that, Mitch,
yeah.
But sometimes it's a real challenge for me, at least.
I'm really committed to 329 and 27 and any combination that comes out of that. And I'll fight like hell to get them through here in the House. But I frankly think anything that requires in the intermediate term, say the next 5 or 6 years, a dramatic change in Medicare or a dramatic change in the Internal Revenue Code or a dramatic change in ERISA is just not going to be likely to happen. So what I think we need to do, and whether it's 368 or the combination of 329 and 27 that comes out, is I think we need to have a stepwise plan that allows us to do what we can do given what we think we can get, what we can do first, and then be moving in very dramatic directions. I think we could change the healthcare delivery system without a dramatic change in Medicare. Or maybe without even internal revenue change. And so what I think we have to be groping for at this point is what can we get that's, well, in health behavior terms, when we get people to change behavior, we talked about behavioral changes that were small enough to accomplish but big enough to make a difference. And what I'd love to see, you know, something I've been fooling around with, as I've said before, for about 50 years now, I'd like to see a roadmap that gets us to where we are, but that does some real things while we're waiting for some of the things that are less likely to be available. So I'd like to have this sort of pragmatic optimism that says let's get what we can this year, next year, the year after that, and then let's be trying to do something greater downstream from those things.
Yeah, for this time, I absolutely get you. Thank you. Ben.
Well, I was just going to say that I think our challenge and our opportunity is to grapple with the immediate and set into motion delivery system changes that, regardless of where we are in the waiver process, which I fully support, you know, allows us to get immediate
gains, accomplishments, and better service delivery as we go forward. Because, I mean, waivers, and for those of you who have, you know, are sitting behind this dais and most of you out in the audience, you know, these things are not done in, I'll be kind, shall I say, a timely fashion. So I think Mitch's point is exactly correct, is that our challenge is to create a bill that allows us to move forward in the here and now with the anticipation, but not requirement, that these waivers are coming, although I think they will, we just don't know when. So I think it's very important to include the waiver request in the bill, and yet at the same time allow some immediacy in our actions to deliver effective, affordable health care here in Oregon. I mean, it just makes perfect sense to me. And that's what I heard Mitch say, and if that's not what you heard him say, then you're wrong.
I think that's what Mitch said.
That's what I heard you say.
Yeah. Further comments?
I agree.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm going to add one little layer to this, and then I'm going to take the chair's prerogative, and we're going to put this on the shelf and come back to it later.
May I say something else, Mr. Chair?
No.
Excuse me.
Going to, anyway.
I think part of what we're seeing in all three of these bills is really a symmetry and an elegance around Mitch's comment. Short-term, intermediate-term, long-term. And while we can't hinge our hopes on any of these actions, all three of those steps are critically important to get to the macro solution we all know needs to come. And you can't do that without asking for some significant flexibility from the federal government to loosen the strings that bind in how we deliver health care. And more than that, I think just asking those questions helps move this nation towards a fairer, equitable, more equitable, cost-effective healthcare delivery system. I am very excited about that opportunity.
Anything further? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say I agree with this notion of moving in the short term on what we can actually accomplish while we're working on the long-term waivers, perhaps. And I just would ask that we continue to keep that in this sort of unrolling of this. We continue to keep that Medicare waiver up front and center and not lose sight of the possibility that 2007, 2008 would be a transformative year at the national level, that by injecting this into the dialogue, and this is certainly Governor Kitzhaber's point, that by sort of really pushing the envelope here, we might see unexpected, and I'm, you know, a youthful optimist, but that we might see unexpected change federally.
I ran a Medicare waiver program for more than 20 years that required congressional action every 2 years to continue to maintain. It was a social HMO project, and we got congressional action every 2 years at the last minute. But we ran it 20 years, still running, I guess, 22 years as a federal demonstration that required congressional action every 2 years.
In the Medicare program. Senator Morsette.
The ultimate irony would be if we had such a successful local program and they decided to redistribute Medicare dollars that they would look at us and say, you guys are doing fine without it, and we're going to give the money to the states that aren't doing so well. So let's build a really great program.
Bill, I'm with you, buddy.
which is exactly where we are right now compared to the rest of the country. Let me offer a couple of thoughts, and then we're going to move on. We often, in this endeavor we're in, are very dangerously close to throwing out the good for the perfect, and we have to be careful with that. And I think the way it's been characterized here tonight by the committee is appropriate. Careful, stepwise, thoughtful. Ben mentioned the delivery system, which I think may be one of the key things we'd be talking about if we actually did continue to push this at the level of the federal government for a waiver. Not necessarily going after dismantling of Medicare or changing in benefits, but saying that we want to deliver it differently. A delivery difference might actually enhance the program so that Medicare recipients would be able to have better home care, better long-term care, wouldn't have to spend down and to drop themselves into a Medicaid program, that they might have more of a team approach to their health care and a multitude of other things that could be done. Some of that would probably require a Medicare waiver to allow us to do it at the state level. Some might not. Mitch, you've already mentioned a program that you know of, that you helped found and run, that required obviously some form of federal involvement to allow you to run the program. So I'm asking us to keep this on the burner, think about it, and understand that Medicare cannot ever be completely taken off the table. It's too big a program and one that's going to probably grow, especially in this state, somewhat faster than other states because of the aging population. So, Janine, you want to go on to the next bullet here?
Sure. The next one is a need for phased in approach to reform, which is just what you were talking about. And it is implicitly implied in the principles of 329 and 27, but not specifically addressed. There's an error, actually, that 3368 actually does have it explicitly written out. So, but I think that all couples with what you were just talking about and whether you want to put more explicit language in the compilation bill. The next section, shall I move on, is to realign incentives to improve cost effectiveness and quality, and this is outlined in all three bills.
I'm going to begin to get, we've got 15 minutes left here. This is a key part of this program because it allows us to get to the factor I'm most concerned about, which is cost. And I'm going to ask we come back to this on Wednesday.
Okay.
Let's skip over and go to the next one.
I'll tell you right now, I see three yeses across the board, so this is simple. Put it in the bill.
Okay. Dave can talk about it all he wants to on Wednesday.
The next two are talking of kind of about participation and population covered, with this one below it talking about specifically regarding to subsidies. But in participation, the 329 talks about every eligible Oregonian with some determination of eligibility requirements. 27 is basically more of the public education model. Everyone is in and are all presumed eligible. And then in 3368, it's more talking about the, again, since it's talking more about just the exchange, it's voluntary for employers and individuals. There's incentives to try to participate.
Can we have a little discussion here just real quickly? I know of two conditions or two groups we need to talk about very quickly here. One is pre-existing conditions from out of state coming into state strictly for a 100% universal plan. Laura, do we have language that addresses that?
It's down under Bennett. Senator Bates, you do have some language in Section 8 and 13. If you look down at the benefits line, pre-existing condition exclusions would be developed and made by supplemental coverage. And I think there's some other language regarding, I'm not sure if that's in 8 or 13.
Does 3368 address that at all?
3368 doesn't address it. The difference, if I might add, Chair Bates, is that 3368 starts out with sort of an expansion of what could be done now, and then it creates an exchange, and the sort of the purpose of the exchange is to fully roll out the rest of the recommendations of the Health Policy Commission. Archimedes says, let's do some committees that will come up with how we're going to do this. Let's get federal approval to do it. And the 329 draft does it sort of creates this board that's going to develop the policies and further implement. So I think anything about pre-existing exclusions Well, it's explicit in 329. It's just one of the issues that they might have to deal with under both Senate Bill 27 and 3368.
If 3368 is written right now, that if someone came to the state with a pre-existing condition, they could go through the exchange and potentially get insurance. But would they would come under, I assume, the present system, which says by insurers that we have a right to not enroll you. There's no guaranteed issue.
Chair Bates, I think the theory behind both House Bill 3368 and Senate Bill 329 is that you create an entity, and I love the Orwellian reference, that has the ability, the capacity to negotiate with health plans and therefore improve quality, improve comprehensiveness of the plans while reducing costs. I think they're both sort of the same theory of leveraging as much money as you can to try to get in a good position with the health benefit plan so that you can get the best packages available. So I think in either scenario you would have a bargaining position that either the exchange or the board would have that you might be able to minimize or at least spread the risk about pre-existing exclusion so that they wouldn't have to contain them in an individual plan, because the risk would be spread more evenly among the whole population of the state.
So those two plans are in common that way then.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think this point really illustrates what we're talking about here in term of this staged or transitional process. The difference in eligibles, 329 presumes, all Oregonians are eligible, with the exception where we bump up against ERISA law by excluding self-insureds. 27, makes the assumption that the waivers are in place and that therefore all Oregonians would be included in the pool. They're really, 329, I think, is correct. Let's do all we can right now. And 27 is correct when we, finally get to that point where we get the waivers. Okay, everyone's in. I think that's a perfect example of what Mitch was just talking about on the earlier point.
How do we define resident? Do we have a waiting period for someone with a serious condition to come into the state and get service? I know we've had this discussion.
Very specific legal definition.
Which is?
I don't know, just it was there.
It's convoluted, but I when I read it two or three times, I understand it. What we're looking at, there's two issues here. When we say eligible Oregonian, one, if you're already in the state, you have a job, and you have a pre-existing condition, you're in, which is a big change. But we're all in the same pool that way, so you're not concerned about, market share or having at risk higher than others. What we don't want to have happen is people who have a pre-existing condition flooding the state because they get access here they don't get in their home state. That's the way it was written at one point. Lori, I think, Lori, you helped write that, if I remember correctly.
Chair Bates, I think... I'm not sure that any of them specifically talk about resident, but I know that in 329, that in order to address the concern of people coming into the state just to get coverage for a treatment or for a condition, that there was the authority to impose a pre-existing condition exclusion so that people would not have the incentive to come into the state. I don't think 27 or 3368 get into that. They just, I think you do have to be a resident, which means that you intend to live here.
Well, may I? Pre-existing conditions may be hard to identify. There may be people who know that they have a pre-existing condition and they appear to be perfectly healthy, and they will move to the state and live here for a year or however long it takes to establish residency for other things. And so we can't avoid that completely, but I'm curious about the short-term way of dealing with it, and I still don't understand what you said. But that's okay.
It's okay.
You guys do, and I missed a conversation.
And there's, I understand your point, but it's try to go get life insurance if you've had a serious pre-existing condition. I mean, there's a national network that knows your health history if you have a significant pre-existing condition.
Unless you just got it and didn't tell anyone.
Well,
or no one's aware of it. But there are a few. Generally speaking, if you have a pre-existing condition that nobody can see, obviously, then you don't know about it either.
Yeah. And would you be moving to Oregon on the presumption you have this pre-existing condition? That's, you know, it's going to happen every once in a while.
It will happen, and I don't want to dwell on that, but I just was curious about, and I must have missed a conversation somewhere, which
I think some of those conversations may have occurred in the interim when we were developing this in the committee or in the commission, and my sense of that, as I remember it, was that the present insurance companies have done a very good job of dealing with this problem. They know a 6-month or 1-year wait is appropriate, so that people don't come in just for that purpose, don't try to get health insurance, because their problem is not people coming in from out of state. Their problem is someone who has a pre-existing condition, know they've got a pre-existing condition, and lives in the state and doesn't have health insurance, and then buys health insurance just to get that covered. Once it's taken care of, they drop back out again. So the risk isn't shared. And the programs they've developed for that really work fairly well.
I guess, may I? Mm-hmm. The reason I mention that is because this will be one of the major issues when we take it out to the public. People are going to raise this question over and over and over again. What about, you know, illegal aliens? What about people who move into the state and have a condition that we don't know about? They may know, but, you know. So that's going to be an issue, and we have to address that.
And that's why the phrase is eligible Oregonians, not residents of Oregon.
Yeah.
That's why we chose that to be the phrase. The board would...
We'd sort that out. I mean, that's one of the activities you gave them, was to sort out the eligibility requirements. So it isn't that you had resolved it entirely in your discussions. It's that would be one of the activities or functions of the trust board.
And under Medicaid law, you can't require, because it's a federal program, a federal match fund, you can't require any eligibility at all, which is a real problem for us at times. It's not one that's expensive for us, but it's one that leads to a lot of difficulty when people come in with a specific problem, come in, get it taken care of, and then leave. That is a difficulty. And whether we can get a waiver to deal with that or not would be also a good question to be asked.
Chair Bates, Senator Morissette, I think that's an issue that is worthy of further research. And I don't know if Dr. Smith's office has done anything along that lines, but whether or not people will pack up and move to another state to get the insurance coverage.
And I don't have any studies that I can quote at the moment, but we can look into that. I know, for instance, Illinois has all kids are covered, have had all kids covered for 6 months, and from talking on the phone to a few people, they're asking some other questions. They haven't had everyone in the lower 48 come and move to Illinois, so there is, but I don't know if anyone's done any specific studies to look at, and it's probably too soon to tell yet in Massachusetts or some of those other states. But we could look into it for you.
Mr. Chair, it certainly has been studied with respect to the states that are covering all kids. We heard testimony when we heard the Healthy Kids Bill on those exact numbers. They were low, 1-3%.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of crowd out,
right.
Crowd out of people dropping the coverage within the state. But I'm not sure about
moving,
state to state. I haven't seen
those
studies. You're
right, that's maybe a separate issue.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Our own experience with the Oregon Health Plan is we have individual cases which really raise people's blood pressure, and rightly so, people in the state on Medicaid just to get a particular treatment and then leaving or even staying. And that's been a real anecdotal problem. But on a broader aspect of what's been the real cost of the state, it's been minimal.
Right, correct.
In the overall program. So people have not moved to Oregon when we opened up the Oregon Health Plan and increased access to that program. But whether that would hold true for an entire state across the whole spectrum, I don't know for sure. And what experience they've had in Illinois might be interesting, not only from the point of view of how many might have moved, but more importantly, did those people have, you know, those children have serious pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
They have leukemic problems or things that are chronic long-term and
it may be too soon yet to get really good data, but we could take a peek. I guess to finish this page so that you're not here forever tonight, the subsidies for low income are delineated by each of the bills, with 329 going up to 300% of federal poverty level. Archimedes doesn't really specifically talk about a particular level because, again, it's a kind of a global benefit that everyone in the state has. And then the Representative Greenlick's version of the bill has some expansion for children up to 300% and the adults up to 200%. I think the overall Health Policy Commission was thinking we would try to maximize for both children and adults to 300 because that's what Massachusetts has successfully gotten through their waiver application, that we would try to get as much match as possible for the adults.
And going back to my earlier statements about how this program might actually be implemented, we might even go above 300% if we get the waiver to do so, knowing that the program for those people in the upper income areas would be subsidized, but that a great degree of the cost would be on the individual or on the individual company. So without getting into crowd out, we can move on. Benefits?
And benefits, again, was trying to delineate who actually set the benefits, not exactly what the benefits were. But in 329, the board determines a set of essential health services determined by the Health Services Commission. And you had discussions about pre-existing conditions excluded and may buy supplemental. Well, 27 also uses the Health Services Commission, and high-risk costs could be spread across the entire population, and you could buy supplemental coverage on top of whatever is being offered by the program. And then in the only the exchange, but they would negotiate and collaborate with the insurers to develop a benefit package, but with the qualifying that the ones that are eligible for subsidy were going to try to fit some standard rather than all of the packages.
I assume the committee realizes we basically had this conversation earlier in the evening, and 329 and 27 are so close to the same here, I don't think there's a large area of disagreement. The exchange, though, is quite different, and that the benefit package will be negotiated for this exchange pool, if I understand it correctly.
They did. The Health Policy Commission talked about using the Health Services Commission as the basis for that, but there wasn't clear-cut language in 3368 to say that the bills are exactly the same.
I wouldn't like the 3368 version of that. I think it's far superior.
Thank you, thank you, Senator. It is 7 o'clock. We're all tired. It's a Monday night. I thank you all for hanging in there with us, and I'm going to call this committee meeting adjourned. We will meet again Wednesday and continue this discussion, knowing that it's leading us directly to a combination bill. Thank you. Adjourned.